Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us today. My name is Rowan Sandhu, and I'm one of the account managers here at Canada Life. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by my colleague, Neil Jones, who's one of our technical managers and a member of our award-winning ICANN technical support team. This morning's webinar will look at chargeable gains with a focus on exit strategies, deferred tax, and policy surrenders. We'll also look at the tax benefits that both onshore and international bonds can offer when it comes to making an exit. So before we get started, just a quick couple of housekeeping points to cover off. For those of you listening live this morning, CPD certificates will be emailed across to you within the next 48 hours. Unfortunately, if you are listening to this, to the recording of this webinar or via the podcast, then CPD is not available. Talking of the recordings, today's webinar should be uploaded to the archive section of our website within the next 48 hours. As you can see, you have a chat box facility on your screens, so please do raise any questions that you have as we go along, and we'll try and pick these up at the end of the webinar if we have time. There's also a section there for you to download any copies of slides or any relevant handouts and sales aids. So without further ado, I'll hand you over to Neil, who'll talk us through today's agenda. Neil?
Thank you very much, Rowan. Yes, good morning, everybody. Yes, as Rowan says, we've got the downloads, and there's a copy of the slides in there. There's quite a few briefing notes we've got on this, so rather than actually attach lots and lots of briefing notes, we've attached a few documents, but if you download a copy of the slides, there's a link there just to take you to the briefing notes page of our website, and that has links to various different briefing notes which we've got on estate planning, investment bonds, and soon to be a number of pension ones on there as well. But right, okay, so let's focus on today's webinar and what we're going to go through. So we'll cover off a bit about chargeable events and the taxation of bonds. We won't go into that in too much detail because we do that in other webinars, so there's plenty of resource available around that. But we'll just cover off some of the areas which may be of interest around exit strategies. We'll look at the tax efficient release of capital, how top slicing works, again very briefly because this isn't a webinar designed to look at taxation of bonds. We'll look at the ownership of the gain and how that can be deflected with appointments and assignments. We'll look at dividend income and the impact that chargeable gains have on dividend income, and then we'll also look at some of the school fees planning and the segmentation and how the benefits of these can be very valuable, especially when you're considering exit strategies of any of your clients. So if we move on, first off, we'll just cover off the differences between UK and international bonds, a bit of housekeeping really and a bit of a refresher. But if we look at the UK-based investment bonds or UK-based providers that offer investment bonds, well, they pay 20% corporation tax in the fund. So on any income that they get, any interest and rental income, there's 20% corporation tax. And there's also 20% on any capital gains that are realised in the fund. Now, when they have capital gains, when there's any equity-based investments, they are deemed gains. So once a year, the provider is deemed to have sold and then repurchased those assets. So it keeps the gain down to a minimum, if you like, because every year it's going to be taxed. So that on an ongoing basis, obviously, when they realise any gains, it only goes back to when it was previously assessed. But there's corporation tax that you get within the life fund. Interestingly, for the last 18 months or so, there has been no UK tax on dividend income. So any UK dividend income that's generated in the life fund, there is no tax, and that's quite valuable. So for certain types of investments are much more tax efficient for UK-based investment bonds than they used to be. Now, the advantage of using a UK investment bond is that you get, or the client gets, a basic rate tax credit on any gain that they realised, irrespective of what tax has been paid in the fund. Now, as you can see, the tax on the corporation tax paid in the fund varies depending on the types of assets and the timings. But HMRC just basically say that's equivalent to basic rate income tax because it's just easier to do so, and it just covers off the tax that's roughly been paid in the fund. In general, investment bond funds you'll find will pay below 20% tax. If we compare that to an international bond or an offshore bond, generally these are written through low tax jurisdictions, such as Isle of Man and Ireland, which we use. There's also Luxembourg, Gibraltar, and so on, which other providers use. UK market tends to gravitate towards the Isle of Man and Ireland because of language and time zones. But these jurisdictions don't have any local tax for UK residents who hold investments in those jurisdictions. And because the provider is not UK-based, there's no UK tax within the bond either. So you get the benefit of what's called gross roll-up or near gross roll-up because the money can sit in the investment. There's no tax to suffer on it. And so therefore the gross amount is invested and the gross amount has to be brought on it without the 20% tax charge that you'd get onshore. Now, there can be some withholding tax on some foreign dividends, like we used to have in the UK with the 10% withholding tax. These generally can't be reclaimed, so depending on what they're investing in, depends whether they're actually tax-free or not, so you can't actually say they're tax-free just in case there is any withholding tax. Generally, people would also use gross share classes just to make sure that they're benefiting fully from the use of an offshore bond. But when the money comes out of the bond, there's no tax credit given, and so therefore the full gain is taxed, and we'll come on to that later on. We've got some slides around that. So chargeable events, this is when there's personal tax. So a policyholder, you'll probably be familiar with some of these. So an investment bond is written under life assurance legislation. Even when it's on a capital redemption basis, even though it doesn't have a life assurance, it's still treated as a life assurance policy for tax purposes. And there's a series of chargeable events on which a policyholder will be assessed the tax. And that's when there's the death of the last life assured, and that gives rise to a death benefit being paid. An assignment of the policy or any rights under the policy for money or money's worth. So that's where there's a consideration and the person assigning the policy gets something in return for making that assignment. If they assign as a gift, it's not a chargeable event. Maturity, we always put this one in. Generally, investment bonds don't mature, but there are some of our estate planning products that do have maturities, and that is a chargeable event as well. Excess withdrawals, investment bonds allow 5% withdrawals for a period of 20 years until the amount of capital has been returned and for tax purposes is deemed to be return of capital. So they're allowed to take withdrawals out, and providing they stick within 5% a year, or 5% a year allowance, then there is no chargeable gain. If they exceed that, then there will be, and we'll come on to that again a little bit later. And then you've also got surrendering. So if anybody surrenders either the whole bond or any of the policies under the bond, that then is a chargeable gain as well, a chargeable event as well. And all of these give rise to a chargeable gain calculation. Interestingly, switching between funds is not a chargeable event, so the client can switch as much as they like, unlike some other types of investments. And generally, if there's a joint ownership under a bond, it's deemed to be owned 50-50, unless there's some way in which it's demonstrated that it's not owned 50-50 and the money has been put in unequal amounts. Now, when we have a look at chargeable events, as I say, you've got the individual or the policyholder, the policy is liable to UK income tax if they're UK resident. They've got the 5% each year, so they're allowed to use that. As I say, you can take 5% for 20 years or 4% for 25 years, or you can take some and then stop and start the withdrawals, but providing you stick within that, there is no immediate tax liability. Now, we don't say that these 5% are tax-free, because they're not, because when somebody surrenders a bond, however, further down the line, those withdrawals come back into the calculation, and so therefore they're deemed to be tax deferred rather than tax free. And you'll see that in some of the literature that providers have. Now, when we calculate a chargeable gain, or an individual has to calculate a chargeable gain, if it's on death, assignment, maturity, or surrender, so in which case the ownership of the policy comes to an end, there's a formula that HMRC use. There's example, if you download the slides, there's some examples of these calculations. I won't go through them on the screen because that will just take up too much time. But the formula for calculating the chargeable gain is you look at the total benefits under the policy. So that's basically the surrender value and any withdrawals that have been taken. You look at the allowable deductions, which basically is the amount that's been invested, because they don't get taxed on their original capital. And then you've got any previous gains that are assessed. So that just stops, you have that as a separate factor because it stops people being assessed twice on the same withdrawals. Now, when these occur, the gain is assessed in the year that the event occurs. So if we have a look at a timeline where you've got the various tax years and we have a client who does a policy surrender halfway through the tax year, well, the gain is assessed in the particular tax year that, that surrender or the death claim or the maturity took place. So you need to plan. So if you've got somebody who's going to surrender policies and you know they're going to surrender them, they can assess them in the right tax year. And if possible, you can manipulate the income. Sometimes people will surrender segments of a policy, some in 1 year, some in the next, just to spread the gain around over a couple of tax years. Now, when there's an excess withdrawal that's been taken, this is taxed slightly differently. So if anybody exceeds the 5% allowance, the actual chargeable gain is the amount over the 5% that they've taken, irrespective of the value of the policy. And the chargeable event doesn't actually arise until the day before the next policy anniversary. And that's because the policy is still running although they can take withdrawals out part of the way through a policy year, they could take more in the future. So there's no point doing a chargeable gain calculation at the time the excess is taken, because it might be exceeded even further during the policy year. So if we have a look at how these are, or the timing of the chargeable gain assessment. So again, we've got our timeline of tax years running from the 6th of April, and we've got an excess partial surrender partway through a tax year. Now, if we take, for example, the policy year isn't very rarely going to match the tax year. So in this example, you've got the policy anniversary starting around about May, June time. Then there's an excess surrender. The chargeable event won't be assessed until the following tax year, because it doesn't arise until the policy anniversary. Now, that gives some planning opportunities for advisors and clients, because what you can do is, if you've got a client, especially with the pension freedoms that we've got at the moment, if you've got a client where you can manipulate their income, maybe they have dividends or they're using drawdown, and you can stop their income or reduce it down, it can reduce the effect of that chargeable gain in the tax year they're being assessed. There's also the opportunity that if they do take an excess partial surrender, and maybe they've done it by mistake, maybe they haven't spoken to a financial advisor before they've done it, what they can do is they can surrender the bond before they get to the policy anniversary, and that effectively wipes out that chargeable gain, because it never gets to the point where that gain arises. What HMRC will do is they'll take the surrender that's been taken, or the partial surrender that's been taken, and effectively add that back onto the surrender value, and then just do a standard chargeable gain calculation. So if somebody has taken it, then there is something they can do about it, but it's not an open-ended option. It's something they have to do rather quickly, depending on timings. Now, the other thing to bear in mind when people are talking about excess withdrawals is around disproportionate gains. This was some legislation that the government introduced recently. There was a very famous case, famous in certain circles, a gentleman by the name of Juice Lobler, who took an excess withdrawal, or he actually took two excess withdrawals out of a very large investment bond that hadn't been invested for a long period of time. That generated massive artificial chargeable gains. So the value of the policy hadn't moved that much, but because he was taking huge withdrawals out of the bond, he generated huge chargeable gains, and they ended up going to court. Now, HMRC introduced an option after that, where if there is what we call a wholly disproportionate gain on a policy, then the client or the policyholder can actually ask to have that recalculated. HMRC have to agree, unfortunately, they don't define what wholly disproportionate is. But if you do pass that test and they agree that it's disproportionate, then they will assess it on an economic basis. Again, they don't define what economic is. So it'll be interesting to see. I don't think any cases, as far as I'm aware, have actually gone through this process, but it'll be interesting to see. Unfortunately, providers aren't included in the process. So for us to actually see this is a bit difficult. But if one is recalculated, because it is deemed to be wholly disproportionate, then HMRC will deal with the client, provide them with the correct chargeable gain, which they should be paying, and then the client will have to keep hold of the paperwork and the information around that, because we, as a provider, as I say, we're not involved in the process. We will quite happily then carry on producing chargeable event certificates on a policy which may not accurately reflect the client's tax position, and the client will have to bear that in mind in the future. So important for a client to get financial advice around taking money out when they're taking excess withdrawals, just to make sure they don't exceed the amount that they need, or the amount to produce a chargeable gain. Now, when there is a chargeable gain, the order of taxation is something that we need to bear in mind. So when they're taking money out, whether it be by surrender or by excess withdrawals aren't taxed because they're tax deferred, but certainly if they exceed it. So we need to consider the order in which HMRC tax income. Now, the first income, we'll keep this very high level, but the first income that goes into the calculation is basically earned income, or non-savings, non-dividend income. So this is, say, salary, wages, income from pensions, maybe buy-to-let properties if they've got any. So any sort of income like that goes into the calculation first, and obviously that uses up the personal allowance first. After that comes savings income. So anything like interest payments from bank, building society accounts, corporate bonds, and so on. So any interest payments go into the calculation next. Interestingly, that includes gains made from life insurance policies where there is no tax credit given on it. So basically offshore bonds. So that can be offset again against the personal allowance if there is any. can be also be used against the starting rate of income tax, which is the £5,000 band at 0%, and also the personal savings allowance if the client actually qualifies for one. After that comes dividend income. They hope that now gets a dividend allowance, which is £2,000. And then following that comes gains on life insurance policies where there is a tax credit. So from that, you will see that in international bonds get taxed with all the other savings income, whereas UK bonds come into the equation at the end. Now, they're both classed as savings income, it's just one's got a tax credit and one hasn't. So just need to bear that in mind, because as we move through some of the examples, you'll see that onshore and international have advantages and disadvantages in certain scenarios. Now, if we look at the tax that people will have to pay in this current tax year, they've got a personal allowance of £11,850 and there's a basic rate band of £34,500. These figures will be updated, obviously, in April next year, and we'll probably find out what they will be in the budget on the 29th. So the basic rate band, if any savings income is allowed to use the starting rate band of £5,000, well, that does count towards the basic rate band, but it's actually money that's taxed at 0%. You've also got the personal savings allowance, which again uses up the basic rate band, but people can have £1,000 worth of savings income without paying any income tax on it. And then you've also got the dividend allowance of £2,000, again taxed at zero, but does use up the basic rate band if it falls in it. So if we take that and have a look at how international bond gains work, obviously we saw onshore all sits on top of the income. But international bonds don't. So if we take a few examples here where we've got a client with a chargeable gain and some income. So first off, we've got a client who's got a chargeable gain that uses up the personal allowance and part of the starting rate band. Well, they're going to pay 0% on both those because it's A, the personal allowance is chargeable at 0%, and then the starting rate band is charged at 0% too. So they're not going to pay any tax on that money. If they have a small amount of income and still have a chargeable gain on top that sits underneath the end of the starting rate band, well, their income goes in first, that uses up part of the personal allowance and is therefore taxed at zero. Then we've got the rest of the chargeable gain, well, that also falls into the zero rated bands as well. So again, there's no tax to pay in that instance. If we then have a bit more income, which pushes the client's chargeable gain into the basic rate band, well, the income again is part of the personal allowance, so it's 0%, as is part of the chargeable gain and the starting rate band. But then the little bit that falls into the basic rate band, if that's £1,000, that gets to use the personal savings allowance, and that's taxed at 0% as well. So as you can see, an offshore bond or an international bond can benefit from £17,850 worth of tax allowances before tax gets paid for somebody who has no other income and whose total gain doesn't take them into higher rate tax. So it can be very beneficial, and that's just gain. That's not what they're taking out of the bond. That's just the gain that they're being assessed on. If we take another example where there's a lot more income, so again, that uses up the personal allowance. Some of it goes over the personal allowance. That's going to get taxed at 20%. The chargeable gain sits on top. You've then got the part of it falls in the zero rated starting rate band. You've also got the personal savings allowance, and then anything on top of that then falls in the 20% bracket. And our final example where there's a lot more income. So personal allowance, the starting rate band is completely used up by the non-savings, non-dividend income. So therefore that's all taxed at 20%. Pushes it into the 20% tax band as well. And then you've got the chargeable gain on top. So they will have their personal savings allowance, which they can offset against the chargeable gain. The balance that falls into the basic rate band will be taxed at 20%, and anything over the top would be 40%. So bear in mind that because their total income is falling into the higher rate tax band, their personal savings allowance is actually reduced from £1,000 down to £500. Even though the exposure to the 40% tax could actually be reduced due to top slicing. So you need to bear that in mind, that it's actually the total chargeable gain arrives at the total income for the client, and the top slicing reduces the tax. And the other important thing is to consider around the offshore bonds or the international bonds is the whole gain sits in the income, it will all be taxed at either 20 or 40% once you're above the personal allowance and the starting rate band, and then top slicing just brings it back down if it goes into higher or additional rate tax, but more on that in a few slides time. So tax efficient release of capital. When money people want to get money out of their policies, they can either do it by withdrawals using the 5% allowance, or they can surrender individual policies. And there's a lot more on segmentation we'll come on to. And you've got to ask yourself, well, does the 5% allowance cover what they actually need to take from the policy? If it does, then they can take that money, and there isn't any tax issues, because if you stick within the 5% allowance, it's tax deferred. Don't even have to put anything on a tax return. So nice and clean and easy. But they can surrender a policy if they're going to exceed the 5% and have an artificial chargeable gain. But if they can surrender the policies and pay less tax or no tax, then that could be a better option. But what they can do is also combine the two, which we'll have a look at an example. So if we take our first example, where Mr. Bryce invested £100,000 just over 4 years ago, and he put it into 100 separate policies of £1,000. Now, the current value has actually gone down, obviously had some market difficulties, so it's only worth £90,000, but he needs to take a withdrawal of £45,000 out of that investment. Now, if he took it by a partial surrender, i.e. withdrawal across all segments, he would generate a chargeable gain of £20,000, because he's in his fifth policy year, so therefore he's got £5,000 multiplied by 5 years. That's his allowance. That only gives £25,000, so therefore the excess he's taken is £20,000. So he would have a £20,000 chargeable gain on an investment that's fallen in value, which is not very sensible. So therefore, look at other options. We've got surrendering 50 of the policies. Well, if the policies are all worth £90,000, he needs 45, and there's 100 policies, so therefore he would have to surrender 50 policies. Each of those policies is showing a loss, and so therefore there is no chargeable gain for actually surrendering the segments under the policy. The thing to bear in mind is, moving forward, his 5% allowance is reduced because he's only got 50 of the 100 policies left. So his 5% allowance moving forward will be £2,500 a year rather than £5,000, although he would have the unused 5% available from previous years. The other thing to do is to a combination. So if he didn't want to surrender and wants to make sure he maximises 5% moving forward, what they could do is they could surrender 31 of the policies, and that would give them an amount of £27,900. Obviously, on full surrender, the policies have actually gone down, so there's no chargeable gain there. And then he could also take a part surrender using the 5% allowance from the remaining policies, and that could give him his full amount that he wants. And again, there would be no chargeable gain moving forward. Again, the 5% allowance would be reduced, but not by as much. And he's also then crystallised the loss under 31 policies. Because if you'd taken the excess withdrawal of 20,000 and had the chargeable gain, well, you'd have to factor the withdrawals back in at the end. So he's crystallised the loss, which moving forward would cause fewer issues. Now, if we look at our second example, which is Mr. Ryman. So we've got £100,000 again invested, but this time just over 3 years ago, so he's in his fourth policy year. Again, 100 different policies. And we've got a current value of 120,000, so modest growth. And he wants to take a lump sum of 60,000. Again, he wants to take half of the value out of the policy. If he took a partial surrender, his 5% allowance is obviously £5,000. He's in his fourth policy year, so that would mean he's got £20,000 allowance. He wants 60, so we've got a chargeable gain of £40,000. Again, completely artificial and not realistic given the value of the policy. If he surrendered 50 of the policies, again, he wants to take half the money out, well, he would generate a chargeable gain of £10,000. So you've got 50 policies that are valued at £120 each, and there was £100 into each of those 50 policies. So that's where the chargeable gain of £10,000 comes in. But if he did a combination again, so fully surrendered 40 of the policies, again, he'd have a chargeable gain of £8,000, but then he would be able to take a part surrender using the 5% allowance from the remaining policies, of which there wouldn't be a chargeable gain for that element. So that reduces the tax liability down to £8,000 just by mixing and matching. So it's important to bear that in mind, that if you've got policies that have got segmentation, you can actually use that to the client's advantage, depending on how much they wanted to get out of it. Okay. So top slicing relief also comes into play once there is a chargeable gain. Now this can be used where it takes a charge, where it takes a client from basic to higher or higher to additional rate. It doesn't work for the allowances. So if somebody has an offshore bond gain and hasn't used their personal allowances, you have to have the whole gain onto their income, and only then if it goes into higher rate tax to use top slicing. So you can't make use of the allowances. You only get one of those each tax year, so you can't use them. You can't save them up and use them in subsequent years. So it allows the investor to spread the gain over the complete policy years that the policy has been in force. And also if they top up the policy and it goes into the same policies, then top slicing on the top up itself also goes back based on the number of years that the original policy has been in force. So the thing to bear in mind is, as I said earlier, that when there's a chargeable gain, the whole chargeable gain sits on top of the client's income. That gives you the total income for the tax year, and top slicing is then used to reduce the tax down on that chargeable gain. So you have to bear in mind, if you've got somebody with quite substantial income or quite a substantial chargeable gain, it could take them over the £100,000 threshold and affect their entitlement to the personal allowance. Personal allowance is reduced down for £1 for every £2 over £100,000 income that the client gets. So as I say, you might have somebody who's got an old policy that's been in force for 20 years, but it's got a sizable gain, but even after top slicing, there might not be any tax payable on it. But they would have issues because they would lose part of their personal allowance, and it might see other income taxed rather than the actual gain itself. You've also got the personal savings allowance, where that moves from 1,000 to 500 once you get to higher rate tax, and then down to zero once you get to additional rate tax. So again, it's the total income that would decide that. We saw that earlier with the example of the international gains. You've got the starting rate of income tax is very useful to use. So if somebody's got offshore bond gains, they can use that. But if they've got income elsewhere, then that's not available. Child benefit tax is also another thing to bear in mind. Is that once a client's income goes over £50,000, if they do benefit from child benefit, then they have the high income child benefit tax charge would then kick in, and then would basically they get taxed on the child benefit they receive. So if they go over £50,000, need to be careful with that. And also student loan repayments. There are some mature students, but even if you assign a policy to a child, maybe in their early 20s or late teens, where they've been to university and got a student loan, if they have a chargeable gain on the bond, because maybe the bond's been assigned to them, that could actually force them to actually repay their student loans. So just important if you're changing ownership on them. Okay. I mean, as far as top slicing goes, we'll just do a quick example. But as I say, it's the number of, just cover this slide off before we get to the example. But yes, the number of complete years that the policy has been in force. But there is one exception to that, and that's where there has been two or more partial surrenders or withdrawals that exceed the 5% allowance. Now, there was a change. There used to be a difference between onshore and offshore bonds. An onshore bond, if somebody has an excess withdrawal, the first time they have an excess withdrawal, you top slice back to the start of the policy, because that's the previous chargeable gain or the previous chargeable event. If they then subsequently take a second excess withdrawal, you only top slice back to the first excess, not back to the start of the policy. Now that's always been the case for an onshore bond or a UK bond. International bonds were different up until the 6th of April 2013, at which point they harmonised and basically both get treated the same. So if somebody's got an onshore or offshore bond that was taken out after April 2013 and they do have two excess withdrawals, then the top slicing on that will only go back to the previous 5% excess. If somebody had an international bond that was taken out before April 2013, then they can still benefit from going back to the start of the policy, provided the policy hasn't been varied in a certain way, so sort of change of ownership being the main one. So provided it hadn't been assigned, they still get the benefit of going back to day one. And that can say that came in 2013 when some of the top slicing rules were changed, mainly around time apportionment and so on. But if we have a look at the example that I mentioned, so we've got Erica's got a chargeable gain of £30,000, which is made over five complete years. He earns £25,000, so the gain has pushed his income up to £55,000. It's an onshore bond, so we've got basic rate taxes paid within the bond. 8,650, as you can see on the screen, falls into the higher rate tax bracket, and strictly speaking, gives him a tax liability of £1,730 on the gain. Now, top slicing works by taking somebody's gain and dividing it over the number of years in which it's been made. So if we have a look at our example where we've got the personal allowance, the basic rating of income tax, and the higher rate. So we've got Eric's income and the gain he's made on the policy. We then look at the 4 years that he's had the policy. We don't actually look at the income he's had in those 4 years because his tax position in the year he's being assessed is deemed to have happened every year. So we've got years 1 to 5, he's got the same income for tax purposes. And then what we do is we just divide the gain over each of those years. How does that sit? What tax bracket does that sit in? Well, those gains still sit in the basic rate tax band. He's already paid basic rate tax because it's an onshore bond, and so therefore there's no higher rate tax liability. If his income was slightly higher and he had the gains added to each of the years, then any part that sits into the higher rate tax band, there's going to be a 20% liability for each of those years. So in this example, half of the gain sits above the 20, sits into the higher rate tax band, and therefore he's got a 20% liability on half the gain. Okay. So as for ownership of the gain, so we've looked at what the gain is and how you can use different allowances and benefits to get money out in the different ways in which you're doing it. When there is a gain, you need to consider the ownership of it and who's liable. So if it's a personally owned policy, then the individual is liable if they're UK resident. So if they own the policy themselves, i.e. no trust, or they're the beneficiaries of a bare trust, providing it wasn't set up by the parents and that the beneficiary is a minor, in which case parental settlement rules apply. We've got a little bit on that later on. Or if the money is held in a basically a discretionary trust in which an individual created. So that if somebody creates a discretionary trust, it goes back to them as the settlor. So if we have a look at how we can control a tax using trusts. So if you've got a policy gain, first port of call is going to be the settlor if they're alive in the tax year, at any point in the tax year, and they're UK resident. So if you have somebody who dies halfway through a tax year and then there's a chargeable gain afterwards, but in the same tax year, it's still assessed on the deceased settlor. Now, if they've died in a previous tax year or a non-UK resident and therefore can't be taxed, HMRC will look at the trustees. Now, the trustees paying tax can be quite penal, quite high rates. They have a basic rate tax band of £1,000, and that's spread across the number of trusts set up by the same settlor, or the number of discretionary trusts set up by the same settlor. Once they then exceeded that basic rate band, it's 45% income tax, and they don't get to use top slicing relief. So that's an important thing to bear in mind. So if you've got an investment bond that's held under a trust, need to think that if the settlor's died in the previous tax year, if any liability falls on the trustees, then it could be quite a significant liability. But the other option is to actually pass the money out to the beneficiaries. Now, if the trustees are outside the UK, or they pass or assign, appoint the policy out to the beneficiaries become the new owners, and therefore they are assessed on the chargeable gain. And generally, a beneficiary will pay lower tax than the trustees. So that is one way of deflecting a tax liability from the trustees to the beneficiaries if the settlor is not around. So a good planning point for money or bonds that are held under trust. And this brings us neatly onto assignments and appointments. Now, this is a way that you can change the chargeable person under a chargeable gain. So basically, an assignment is where somebody gets the policy and changes the name of it. An appointment is where it gets put into a bare trust for the beneficiary, and then it gets surrendered. So the tax liability, because it's a bare trust, would fall on the beneficiaries. So from a tax perspective, it's the same thing. So an assignment, obviously giving a policy away, if somebody owns it personally and they assign the ownership to another individual, that's a gift for inheritance tax purposes. So they need to bear that in mind. If it goes to an individual, it's a potential exempt transfer, as it would be if it went to a bare trust. But if we went to a discretionary trust, then it's going to be a chargeable lifetime transfer. So providing they give it away and there's no consideration, then there's no income tax issue with assigning that policy. Obviously, if they do get a consideration, then they're getting something back, so they need to bear that in mind. If the person who receives that bond suddenly chooses to encash it, then any income tax liability is assessed on the new owner, because they're now the policyholder, they're deemed to own it, so therefore the tax liability falls on them, and that, as I say, is a good way of deflecting tax. Appointments tend to be used where any money is going to a minor. So if you need to assign a policy to a minor, well, a minor can't hold a policy, they're not the age majority, so therefore you can't assign to a minor. So therefore what you can do is you can appoint the policy, in which case you're effectively setting up a bear trust, placing the policy in the bear trust, and then if the trustees surrender the policy, in which case the tax point falls on the minor beneficiary, and obviously the money has to be used for the benefit of the minor beneficiary. So very useful for school fees planning or any sort of maintenance for the children and so on. So important thing to bear in mind that that's when you have to go to a minor, it's an appointment rather than an assignment. And so you've got parental settlement rules. So where the income tax, where a parent gives money to a child and the child is below the age of 18, then even if the parent gives them the money, and the tax liability will still fall on the parents, whether they do that directly by giving the money to the child or signing the policy to the child or appointing it, sorry, or whether they do it through a bear trust or they do it through a discretionary trust, it still comes back on the parents. There's anti-avoidance legislation around that. So anything where the charging amount is over £100, it's going to get taxed on mum and dad anyway. So the important thing is that the assignee or the beneficiary is going to deem to own that bond from outset. So the gain is assessed on them. They get to use top slicing back to the start of the policy, or if they're taking an excess back to the previous excess. And they get to use their own tax rates, which generally are going to be, say, lower than the trustees, maybe lower than the settlors. But it's just that's for the trustees and you to decide which is the most advantageous way forward. So we're coming on to dividend income now. So we've got the dividend allowance, which is £2,000. Now, this originally came in and it was £5,000. And there was a lot of people were rejigging around portfolios, because if you had a portfolio of £143,000 and a yield of 3.5%, that basically used up the £5,000 dividend allowance. And then when it got cut down to £2,000, the size of the portfolio reduced to below £60,000. So it does use up part of the tax bands. You get £2,000 is charged at 0%, and anything else on top of that is either 7.5%, 32.5%, or 38.1%. Now, investment bonds, what we saw earlier about the order of taxation, it's different for a UK bond compared to an international bond. So therefore, if you've got people with dividend income and they're looking at investments and they're looking at the tax wrappers, they might want to take this into account depending on what the exit strategy is of the bond. So if we have a look at a graph, try and explain it. So we look at dividend income and international bond gains. So we've got our graph again with a few extra coloured boxes on the right-hand side. So we've got a client who's got some income that uses up the personal allowance in the starting rate. So they've got it taxed at 0 and 20%. They then have their dividend income on top. The first 2,000 is taxed at 0 and the balance taxed at 7.5 because it's all within the basic rate band. Now, if this client then has an offshore bond gain, they have the same income. The offshore bond goes in next before any dividend income. So they get to use their personal savings allowance. So part of it will be taxed at 0% and the balance taxed at 20%. The dividend income then sits on top. They get the dividend allowance at 0%, but then anything else on top of that is taxed at 32.5%. Now, if we compare that to how a UK bond works, personal savings allowance, would reduce from 1,000 down to 500 because they've gone into the higher rate tax band. But if we look at a UK bond and how it works for us in a similar scenario, so same client, just with an onshore bond rather than offshore, they've still got their income, which is taxed at 0 and 20. Onshore bond gains come into the tax calculation after dividend income. So their dividends go in next. So they've got £2,000 charged at 0% with the balance charged at 7.5%. And then you have the onshore bond gain sits on top of that. It's onshore, so anything that sits in the basic rate band is 0%. And then the higher rate band is 20%. But obviously they might have the ability to reduce the tax down through top slicing on that. So as you can see, where there's dividend income involved, you need to consider the different tax wrappers to work out which one is going to be most beneficial. Like, see, one of the questions we've had is around capital gains tax, and just to let you know that capital gains tax rates are decided by total income. So, for example, in the two columns on the right-hand side there, if they had a capital gain tax then liability, then they would be paying 20% on it, because that's falling into the higher rate, because it sits on top of their total income, including the chargeable gain. Okay, so now we have a look at some strategies that people have used around school fees. And we've got a couple of examples and case studies. So we've got, say you've got a grandparent funding for a grandchild. They've got the ability to invest. Generally, they would use an international bond because the child is going to be a non-taxpayer. So therefore, it's just a bit more efficient from a tax point of view. And then as any school fees fall due, they've got the ability to appoint those policies into a bear trust for the minor beneficiary. Now, there's no parental settlement rules because it's grandparents gifting to grandchildren. They have to bear that in mind that it's going to be a potentially exempt transfer. But it does allow the grandparents or the children to actually use the personal allowance and the starting rate band and the personal savings allowance of the child, because you can deflect the tax from the grandparents to the child. Now, there are trust arrangements that they can use, but if they're not using it, they can just appoint the policies over to the grandchild and let them, or let the trustees and the bear trust then surrender in it, and it removes the tax liability. If we're looking at university fees, well, this can be for parents, because generally the children will be over the age of 18. So in this example, we've got some parents who want to make provision for their daughter's future. They're going to university, fees are going to be 20,000. That's going to be living costs as well. And we've worked on a basis that it's going to increase by 3% a year. And she's going to start university in 5 years' time, and she's going to be there for 4 years. So parents have put aside £100,000. Again, she's not likely to be an earner, so therefore they're looking at an international bond because it's a gross roll-up and there's no tax within the fund. So obviously if they use onshore, they can't claim it back if she's a non-taxpayer. Divide it across 1,000 policies, and we work on a 4% net return. So if we have a look at what happens at the end of year five when they start calling on this, well, university costs are going to be just over £23,000. Now, in order to provide that £23,000, they've got to surrender 191 seconds or appoint and surrender 191 seconds. In this instance, they're going to surrender it. Their encashment value is going to be just over what they need, but they've got a gain of £4,000, which will generate £1,600 worth of tax because they're higher rate taxpayers. So although they've realised enough money to actually pay the school fees from their own wealth, the net proceeds means they're going to have a tax liability and a shortfall. If we look at year six, again, the value of the policies has gone up, so has the school fees. Again, they've released enough money to actually pay the school fees, but they're generating a tax liability for themselves. Years seven and eight, exactly the same problem. So they've released enough money to pay it, but over a four-year period, they've generated a tax liability of £8,700 on themselves, which isn't ideal because they've got to pay that money. Now, if they did it slightly differently, where they considered actually appointing those policies out to the child, whether you use a trust or not, but they can appoint the policies to the child or assign them to the child and let her cash them in, they get to use the various tax allowances and the tax brackets. And therefore, what they can do is when you look at the table that we just saw where they've paid all their tax, they can still realise the same amount of money from the policies by surrendering the required number of segments, but there's no tax to pay because it's all going to be zero charged, falling within the basic rate, personal allowance, the starting rate, and the personal savings allowance of the daughter. So very, very useful that even if they're not using trusts, they can just assign money over. Now, parents from an IHT point of view have an exemption where they're doing education and maintenance costs for children in certain criteria, in certain circumstances. So from an IHT point of view, then there might not be an issue, or there shouldn't be an issue if they do it correctly. And then we just remove the income tax problem that the parents may have with doing school fees. Now, when we look at segmentation, we do get asked sometimes around what's the full benefit of segmentation? And do you really need lots and lots of policies? So we put some slides on here just to try and explain it. Again, we've used a 4% net growth. We've looked at an investment term of 15 years just to show the difference between different policies that segment in a different way. So if we've got a client or got an investment, we'll just say 300,000. You can do it in different amounts. We did this up to 1 million and the figures were virtually the same. So if you've got 10 segments under the policy, in 15 years' time, each segment is going to be worth £54,000. So each segment has got a gain of £24,000. Now, to to realise any money out of it without paying tax, they can't have a gain of over £17,000. So if they wanted to get money out without paying tax, they can't. If they surrender one segment, they're going to have a tax liability. So therefore, there's no ability to take any money out of it in a tax-efficient way, unless they do the 5% withdrawals. If you've got 100 segments, well, the value of each segment is going to be $5,400, a gain of $2,400 per segment. There is the ability, therefore, to surrender the required number of policies, which is going to produce an encashment value of £37,820. So the ability for the client in that situation means that they can get just shy of £38,000 out before they start paying tax, provided they've got all their allowances available. If you increase it to £1,000, well, the segment size obviously gone down, but it's £5,400, gain of £240 on each segment, which means that they can actually then surrender more policies, and it gives them the ability to get just under £40,000 out of the investment before they start paying tax, again, assuming that they've got the full £17,850. And then if you have the maximum amount of segmentation, which is £99,999, as you can see, they can take out over £40,000 before they start paying tax. So the benefit of segmentation allows people to generate tax liabilities that can be quite precise amounts and allows them to surrender more policies and to extract more growth out of the arrangement just by using multiple segments. And if you have a look at that, comparing 100 segments to 99,000, the client can get out £2,340 more. And if you do that over a period of time, say 4 or 5 years, to coincide with school fees, because it's parents assigning to the children who've got all their allowances, they can get a lot more money out of the investment before they start paying tax. And it just gives them the extra flexibility to be able to do that. So I'm conscious I'm coming to the end of my time, so I'll summarise now. Obviously, there are other things to take into account, which we will say for another day. But this was the summary. This was the agenda that we started with. So we've run through the taxation of bonds and how they work, the ownership, and how we can deflect tax using appointments and assignments of investment bonds, covered off dividend income and segmentation and school fees. So there's a lot to take in there and a lot of different ways in which people can use investment bonds and be able to manipulate the tax liabilities that they've got. Questions? There are some in the question box, which we'll come back and answer any that haven't been answered before the end of the day, hopefully. But I hope you found that useful, and I will hand back now to Rowan. Thank you very much.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for that, Neil. A lot of great information there, which I hope everyone found useful. So as Neil mentioned, we will answer any questions after the webinar via our chat box facility. But thank you very much, everyone, for listening this morning. If you would like to discuss any of the solutions that we've discussed today for your clients, please contact your Canada Life account manager. You can also see the contact details on the screen for our UK and international support and technical teams, who are always happy to answer any questions that you might have. Finally, there will be a short survey for you to complete as you access the webinar. So we thank you for any feedback that you provide us in advance. We will be switching off our audio for now, but we will leave the chat box facility open for the next few minutes for any final questions that you may wish to ask, and we will try to get back to you as quickly as we can. So thank you very much again, everyone, for joining us this morning, and we hope to see you again soon. Goodbye.